available in more homes than the Pac-12 Network, we are the Podcast of Champions. Fight! I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online.
And here he goes, Miles Jack.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com.
Liner going to try to sneak it ahead. Touchdown, SC!
We are the Podcast of Champions. Welcome back, everybody, to the Podcast of Champions. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site of the Scout.com network.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com, the USC site on the Scout.com network, and we are the Podcast of Champions, talking about the Pac-12 bowl season. Couple games in the books. We're going to preview five more of them today on the show. We're going to get to a bunch of your questions, talk about everything that's going on in Pac-12 football. If you have questions for us, a lot of ways you can get a hold of us. The website is Pac-12podcast.com. You can email us, Pac-12podcast@gmail.com. Tweet us at Pac-12 Podcast or leave us a voicemail 641-715-3900 extension 734-972. And Dave, we got some voicemails this week after we made that plea last week, and some of them are a little long.
That's what I like to hear. I mean, I don't necessarily like to hear like 4.5 minutes of somebody's thoughts, but I like to hear that we're having voicemails. I think that really adds to the whole thing for everyone. And I'm excited to hear what we've got. It's gonna be a fun show.
I think it will. So far, Pac-12 is undefeated.
Yep.
I think we went 1-1 in our picks because, New Mexico, Arizona beat New Mexico by,
we're 1-0-1 because the spread that we had for that game, the Arizona-New Mexico game, was -8, I think.
Oh, it was. Yes. Okay.
So Arizona won by 8, so whichever way we could have gone, we tied that one.
Nice. Okay. So not too bad. 1-0-1. And Utah ended up covering. We thought it was going to be they'd win, you know, field goal or so would probably, you know, be or better. So So should we, you want to do our little what we like to call
Pac-12 Roundup?
I do want to do the Pac-12 Roundup. So we got started with, which game do you want to start with, Ryan?
I think the game that was first is the New Mexico Bowl, an away game, essentially, for Rich Rod and the
Arizona Wildcats.
Beautiful, beautiful. Arizona won this game 45-37. They were favored by 8. They won by 8. It was actually kind of the way we thought it would go. It was very much a shootout. New Mexico kind of did what we expected. They ran the ball for over 300 yards. Arizona kind of did what we expected. They moved the ball pretty well, and Solomon had a decent enough game. He was explosive, wasn't super accurate, but when he did connect on passes, he connected for a long distance. I thought the biggest, you know, I think bright spot for Arizona was Caleb Jones, who had 4 catches for almost 200 yards, and I believe all of that came in the first half. Wow. So he had 182 yards at halftime, which I thought was pretty darn impressive. Without Nick Wilson, they still ran the ball really, really well, and it was essentially a true road game. So Arizona ending the season nicely. Rich Rod's coming back. They finished with a winning record. I think given the way that year went with Scooby Wright being out, now it sounds like Scooby Wright's going to the NFL, I think you take it as, okay, they didn't have a complete disaster of a season. Now they get to move on to next year and hopefully build on a pretty nice bowl performance.
Yeah, you hear Rich Rod talking after the game. He pretty much admitted that New Mexico kind of controlled the game a lot of the ways. But, you know, the stars were there, and who knows if you had a healthy Anu Solomon the whole season, if you had a healthy Scooby Wright, what this team could have done. We got to see Scooby Wright make some big plays. He had that sack there towards the end of the game. There was a lot of big plays in this game, just a big plays all over the place. And that big one, I think it was in the early fourth quarter that New Mexico recovered that onside kick. I mean, I thought that was pretty huge, but you know, in the end, Rich, you know, it's like not the most exciting ending. You kick a field goal to go up by 8 and, you know, get the stand at the end. And, you know, it was a weird kind of, you know, probably the first, you know, bowl game out of the chute, kind of what you would expect, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, it's always funky when you have to prepare for one of those triple option teams. You never because it's not something you see in a big league like the Pac-12. I mean, you see it in the ACC, but that's just because of Georgia Tech. You see it in the AAC because of Navy. But it's not something you see with any consistency in the Pac-12. So it's kind of a one-off to prepare for. And yeah, when you're going into a bowl game, you have, you know, for them, it was 2.5 weeks, but you've got time to prepare. But it's still, I mean, it's a whole different thing you're preparing for. And, you know, this sort of thing can happen when you're doing that. And you fold in all the other things, like it's a bowl game where, you know, motivation is always an issue for players because, especially for these third tier bowl games, nobody cares. I think the fact that they were able to defend as well as they were able to was actually a good sign. I mean, yeah, New Mexico definitely controlled the game on the ground, controlled the game from a time of possession standpoint, but Arizona was able to do their own thing offensively. I think they got enough out of Scooby Wright. I think if Scooby Wright doesn't play in this game, Arizona might lose.
Yeah.
But he was able to contribute quite a bit, a couple of sacks, 15 tackles. And I think you could make a pretty easy argument that he was the difference. And, you know, I think he wanted to show everyone he was healthy before declaring. And so I think that's, he definitely showed that. I think he showed that he's in, you know, maybe not tip top, you know, perfect shape right now, but, pretty close to it. And even pretty close to it, I thought was a pretty damn good performance for him.
So winning record for Arizona, they finished 7-6. Congrats to Rich Rod. Not exactly the repeat of the Pac-12 South Championship that they wanted, but maybe a step in the right direction.
Maybe so.
Should we move on?
Let's move on.
All right. The Holy War, Dave, in Las Vegas, where you want your Holy Wars. We had BYU, the arch rival of
Utah Utes.
This was a bizarre game. Just bizarre. If you were just looking at statistics and you kind of avoided looking at turnovers, BYU dominated this game.
Yes.
And they lost 35-28. And here's the thing. It was 35-0 Utah after the first quarter. BYU had 5 turnovers in this game. It was a stunning, awful performance.
The first 5 possessions of the game, they turned the ball over. It wasn't just 5 spread out. It was the first 5.
So, all right, so Utah scored 5 touchdowns and essentially 4 touchdowns in the first half of the first quarter. So it was 28-0 with 7 minutes and 30 seconds to go in the first quarter. 2 of those were pick sixes.
Yeah.
So this was a disastrous beginning to the game for BYU. They just looked completely out of sync. And Utah's defense, you got to give them credit, they were playing really, really well, but just looked completely out of sync offensively for BYU. As you might expect from a team whose entire coaching staff is basically leaving after this year. But, you know, you've got to give credit to BYU because they definitely, despite going down 35-0 early, they kind of fought back into it. They made it a game at the end thanks to some just truly atrocious play from Utah there at the end. But I guess you got to call it a nice win for Utah, despite their offense really not doing much of anything in this entire game. They were still able to pull off the win, but this was probably one of the stranger games I saw all season.
Yeah, I couldn't watch it live, so I watched I knew what the final score was, and I watched the tape. You know, I just taped it and watched it. And when you know that Utah's only scoring 35 points, and it's still the first quarter, and you see them, I'm like, well, I guess Utah's done. You know, like they're just gonna kind of hold on. But that point where you're talking about, I think it was like 7.5 minutes left in the first quarter. Utah had 2 pick sixes. They're up, 28-0. They had 7 offensive snaps at that point, and they were up 28-0. Like, that's ridiculous. But Travis Wilson ended up their 5th touchdown. It was a really nice Travis Wilson run, the kind of what we saw from him earlier on in the season. But then the offense was just awful, Dave. I mean, the Utah offense just couldn't get out of its own way. You could accidentally score somehow in the next 3 quarters, and they just couldn't do it. And it was just the weirdest game. And it's not like BYU came back like gangbusters, but they played solid enough. Even getting buried deep, Hackett was, on his game as far as punts go. He had one that went into the end zone, but the rest he kept burying them inside the 5-yard line. But somehow BYU just kept crawling back and crawling back and, wearing out that Utah defense, and the Utah offense just wasn't giving it any help. So there was a couple 4th-and-1s that Utah went for late in the game, and BYU stopped them both and kind of gave them some momentum. come back with a big pass, or, a bomb or whatever. And at the end, you could understand Kyle Whittingham was pretty upset. He was pretty pissed at the post game. he tried to give credit, but it's just, it's not the kind of way you want to finish out, not just the bowl game, but your whole season. Basically, you played three quarters of kind of stinky football.
You know, I've got a stat that'll tell you everything you need to know about Utah's offensive ineptitude in this game. You ready?
Yes.
Tom Hackett accounted for over a tenth of Utah's offensive yardage with a run. Ray Guy Award winner Tom Hackett,
wow,
punter, accounted for over a tenth of their positive yardage.
That is crazy.
So there you go.
They had the most points they ever had this year in the first half, 35. But they also had the least amount of yards, 76. So it's like, and it just was the weirdest game, Dave.
Yeah, it was very, very strange. That first half, I don't think it lived up to anybody's expectations for this game. It was better in the second half, it was more competitive, but I think everyone, with all the build up for this game, they were expecting some, knockdown, drag out fight that ended, 20-17, huge defensive struggle, lots of, punching each other in the balls, the whole thing. And we really didn't get that. It was a weird beatdown to start out with, and then BYU did enough of a job calling itself back in, but it was just a strange, strange game. No real other way to describe it.
Yeah. All right. Well, should we move on to some of our game previews?
Yeah. Well, this way we don't have to play the Pac-12 Roundup sound again. We can just go straight to the previews now.
Because we're already in the Roundup. We just went from recaps to previews. So next on my list is the Hyundai Sun Bowl. This is in El Paso, Texas. It's between 8-4 Miami and your 8-4
Washington State Cougars.
All right. So this game, two 8-4 teams, Washington State favored by 3 points. This will be on Saturday, December 26th, along with two other Pac-12 games. Comes on at 11 a.m. So when you're getting over that, eggnog hangover the day after Christmas, you'll have something to turn on, I guess. and once again, like always, this will be opposite another Pac-12 game, which starts at 11:20, which we'll get to next. And this will be on CBS. So there you go. Do we have anything from Barry Bolton today?
We do. I'll play it for you right now.
This is Barry Bolton at CougFan.com. Washington State takes on Miami in the Sun Bowl on Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific time, the day after Christmas. Luke Falk returns at quarterback after missing the last 1.5 games with an injury. And while the quarterback is, of course, hugely important to any team's offensive success, it's even more pronounced in the air raid with the number of precision passes made. Falk in practice looks to have picked up where he left off, and it looks like he'll be playing with some other guys that have been missing. Left tackle Joe Dahl and wide receiver Gabe Marks also look to be healed up and ready to play in the Sun Bowl. Dahl missed the last 4 regular season games and is considered Washington State's best offensive lineman. Marks leads the Pac-12 in receptions with 99 and touchdowns with 14, so 2 pretty good pieces, along with Falk, to get back on offense for the Sun Bowl for the Cougs. Miami may have some issues. A couple players are out for the Sun Bowl at safety and on the O-line. It was announced Tuesday, and it doesn't look like Miami's new coach is eager to retain any of the current assistants. But Miami has speed, lots of speed. And a team can win the first 23-24 minutes of the first half against Miami, and 2 Miami explosive plays later, bam, they're tied or even in the lead. Washington State must limit the big plays and stay focused ahead of every snap against a team like Miami. The Canes have a highly rated pass defense, and they've picked off 15 passes this season. Their run defense has been poor, but Mike Leach in the past has preferred to do what his offenses do best, and that's throw the ball. Still, it's hard not to see Wazoo running back Gerard Wicks, Jamal Morrow, and Keith Harrington not getting a few turns here and there to carry the rock and test Miami, particularly out on the edge. Defensively, Wazoo will need to get pressure on the Miami quarterback since Miami's main offensive weapon is its passing game. But Wazoo has had trouble at times this season stopping the run. So even though Miami ranks poorly there in its run game, with a coaching staff that has nothing to lose, I would not be surprised at all to see Miami come out and try to run the ball right at the start of the game and see if they can get the Cougs on their heels. This should be a really good matchup, and most people see the outcome being in doubt until the very end.
right, good stuff from Barry. You know, I'm looking at Miami's schedule this year, and it seems like, you know, they've beaten up on some teams, but most of the teams they've beaten are of the bad team variety. The teams that they've done the best against among good teams, I guess Pitt. If you consider Pitt a pretty good team, they beat them in the regular season finale, but the rest of the time they lose to, you know, good-ish teams and they beat bad teams. I think Washington State is probably in that kind of good team category. I think they're pretty comparable, if not better than Pitt. So this could be just from a quality of team standpoint, I think this could be a tough matchup for Miami. With Luke Falk back, with Gabe Marks back, with left tackle Joe Dahl back, I have to give the edge to Washington State here. I think they're going to be able to move the ball on Miami. Teams with good offenses have been able to move the ball on them this year. Nebraska, which I've been doing a lot of research on because they're playing UCLA, they had a really competitive game against Miami, and they've got a pretty decent offense, and I think Washington State's is a cut above that. North Carolina put up like 59 points on them. Clemson put up 58. And I think, you know, I don't think Washington State's quite at those two teams' level, but I think they're just a small step below that in terms of offensive output. So I can see him putting a lot of points up in Miami. And, you know, I think Barry said that he, you know, expects Miami to run a little bit more in this one to take advantage of Washington State. I really don't. I think a team with a kind of a new coaching staff or an interim staff, I think they're going to try to do what they do. And I think Washington State's been good enough rushing the passer this year that I see them winning this one in the 7-10 point range. I think they're going to put a nice victory together and end the season with 9 wins.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you on that. You know, maybe like a touchdown victory there. I'm going to go a little advanced stats on you, Dave. So
do it. Bring it.
We're going to talk about cities. You're going from Pullman to El Paso. You know, you could argue up a little, down a little, more parallel. But if you're going from Miami to El Paso, that's a huge step down. I think it's going to be a disappointment when they get to the Sun Bowl for the Hurricanes. And so I think the Cougars are going to take care of business.
You know, that's some residual USC attitude from you, I think, because I think USC. So I'm gonna take you a little inside baseball right here. UCLA went to the Sun Bowl the year after USC went, and you want to know what I heard universally from the Bull staff, from the media people, from everyone?
They were really
excited to see us, and they were really excited not to have USC there again. And that goes for everyone. Apparently the media were, you know, bitching the whole time. Us UCLA people, we're just happy to be there. It was excited to be there.
I used to date a girl from El Paso. She hated it too. So
yeah, El Paso is not a great place, but a really, really lovely people who run their bowl game. Really nice, awesome people. Yeah, I see what you're saying though. I think Miami is a destination for a lot of teams for bowl games. I think this is kind of a reverse course for Miami. But for Pullman, I mean, yeah, it's kind of, well, we get to go to Texas where it'll be at least a little bit warmer. Can't hurt.
Right.
So, I like your advanced stats there. I think they make some sense. I think Washington State definitely has an advantage there. I think they have an advantage from a motivation standpoint. I think this could be the capper to a pretty nice season when you get a name opponent in a bowl game, even if they're not, you know, Miami of old, when you can kind of have that name opponent. And you can put together a win, I think it gives you a nice boost heading into next season. So, yeah, I think this will be a nice win, nice little capper for the season for Wazoo.
All right. So that's the Sun Bowl in lovely El Paso. No offense to any El Pasoans out there. Let's move on. Like Dave said, this game is, starts 20 minutes later. Washington State's rival in the Zaxby's Heart of Dallas Bowl against a 9-4 Southern Miss squad. This is played in the Cotton Bowl, and the team is
Washington Huskies.
So if you couldn't get enough Pac-12 North at 11 a.m., you can start again at 11:20 a.m. For whatever reason, they're playing opposite each other, like always in the Pac-12 season. Washington favored by 8.5 over Southern Miss. Washington 6-6, Southern Miss is 9-4. But as we were saying towards the end of the year, nobody in the world wants to play Washington right now. They ended the season on a really, really high note, and have looked really good in the last couple of games. Beat up on Oregon State, then beat up pretty good on Washington State as well. have just been a much more competitive team, and their defense is playing at a really, really high level. Jake Browning has started to come together at the end of the year. So this is going to be a good one. ESPN, day after Christmas, 11:20 a.m., Washington favored by 8.5. What do we have from our dogs?
Here you go.
This is Chris Fetters of Dogman.com, covering the University of Washington for the Scout.com network. And today we're previewing Washington's bowl game, which is down in Dallas. It's the Heart of Dallas Bowl, December 26th at 1:30 in the afternoon, and it's against the Southern Mississippi Golden Eagles. It's obviously a very unique matchup. Pac-12 school against a Conference USA school. Don't necessarily get to see that all that often, but obviously Washington got in as an at-large berth at 6-6, and they finished off strong with their last two wins against Oregon State and Washington State. Coming into this game, it's going to be very interesting because Southern Mississippi has a top 10 offense nationally. They are really, really balanced. They've got 2,000-yard rushers, which is very unique, as well as a quarterback who's thrown for a ton of yards, obviously. So it's going to be a test of Washington's defense, the number one scoring defense in the Pac-12, to establish things early, set a tone, and then let Washington's offense, led by their true freshman, Jake Browning at quarterback and Miles Gaskin at running back, to kind of ease into the game, kind of, you know, get some momentum, get some first downs, and then see what they can do from there. But this is definitely going to be a game that's won or lost in the trenches. And again, it's going to be very, very interesting. A top 10 offense versus a top 30 defense. Now, again, you have to kind of think of these things in terms of, are they relative? I mean, Southern Mississippi is a very, very good team, but they are in Conference USA. They lost the Conference USA championship game to Western Kentucky. So what do you make of it? It's very hard to tell sometimes. And then obviously Washington, very average record at 6-6, but they played in a much, much better conference. So it'll be interesting to see if playing against top-tier opposition week in and week out will spell a difference and allow Washington to beat Southern Mississippi. The other thing that has to be noted, too, is that the Huskies got off to an absolutely horrific start in their bowl game last year, the Cactus Bowl in Phoenix against Oklahoma State. They were down 24-0 at one point, and eventually lost 30-22. So that's really fresh in the minds of Chris Peterson and his staff, and obviously the players that played in that game, and they want to make sure that they set a tone early. So that's another thing to look forward to.
All right. Good stuff from Chris. I think he made the most cogent point about this, which is Southern Miss, I mean, they've played no one this year. I mean, they lost to Nebraska, which is probably, I mean, that's probably the namiest opponent they played. You know, they beat Louisiana Tech. They lost to Western Kentucky. Their schedule is just replete with a bunch of teams that, oh, I guess Mississippi State, they lost to them at the beginning of the year by 18 points. Southern Miss has put up some offensive numbers, but the teams they put them up against are, I mean, it's a bunch of dreadful teams. Marshall beat them by 3 touchdowns. So I'm kind of with the odds makers on this one. I think Washington is substantially the better team from a talent perspective, from a coaching perspective. From a lot of different perspectives. And I think they should be favored by, you know, 8-10 points in this one. I think, you know, for this game, it's kind of a weird bowl. It's not a Pac-12 affiliated bowl. But I think for Washington, it's going to be an interesting, you know, I'm always looking at motivational factors for bowl games, and it's going to be interesting because nobody expected them to be a bowl team this year. I'm sure they had internal expectations to be a bowl team, but they were, you know, the over-under on wins, as we've talked about a bunch, was set at, what was it, 3-4, something like that. Yeah. And they've obviously gone past that. They've probably gone past a lot of people's expectations for this team. Where's their motivation now? Are they super motivated to go to 7-6? Are they not because they've already kind of surpassed their goals? Where does that kind of lie? And he touched on last year where they didn't go into that bowl game looking kind of fully prepared in that first quarter. You know, are they going to have that same kind of lull and intensity at the beginning? You know, I've got a lot of confidence in Chris Peterson as a coach, as a motivator, and he certainly has, you know, a history of pulling off big bowl games, but this is kind of a weird bowl against kind of a weird opponent. I think the motivation, that should be at least a question in the back of your mind going into this game if you're a Washington fan, you know, where their head's going to be, and I think we should be able to see early in the first quarter, but regardless, I've got Washington winning this pretty good. I think they're going to win by a couple of touchdowns.
I'm going to agree with you there. We'll both take UW minus 8.5. You know, kind of a fun offense with Southern Miss. They can spread it around, throwing the football, running the football. But this will be the best defense that Southern Miss has played this season. And I think when you the Washington defense with those young guys, you know, playing crazy football all over the field, being able to do whatever they can do and stop opposing offenses, I think they're going to have a pretty good day against Southern Miss. And you're not going to see the same kind of offensive explosion you normally do. But really, to me, the way Washington's played offensively, especially the last half of the season, just so much better, scoring more points. That's why they're a bowl team now. They're a much more complete team, I think, than they were in the beginning of the season. Jake Browning's matured, and I think he's playing better. So I think it's just going to be like kind of a class thing. Washington's just a better class of football team than Southern Miss. And there's always the, like you said, the motivation factor. You're never sure what's going to happen in a bowl game. But I like what Chris said towards the end. Because they had a bad taste in their mouth with the bowl game last year and you know, getting thumped early and, you know, trying to mount a comeback that was too little too late, I think the motivation will be there, Dave. I think they'll use that from last year. You remember what happened in the bowl game last year? You remember what, you know, this is a team you have to take seriously. So I kind of, you know, anything can happen, but I kind of get the feeling they'll be ready to play. I think if it's an even, if both teams are kind of motivated about the same level, Washington's completely going to outclass them, and I think they'll cover.
Absolutely. Yeah, I tend to agree. And I think it's a cool thing for Washington. They're even in a bowl game this year. And I think that'll be kind of an attitude for them too, where they'll be just excited to be there. And so that'll provide its own motivation. And that's a dangerous team heading into next year. I mean, we'll probably do some sort of early projection show in the next few weeks, but I think you got to look at them as a real contender in the North next year. And I think if they end the season on a high note, you know, bowl games don't really matter, especially these kind of third tier ones. But if you can end it with a 7-6 record and you can end it on a high note where young guys all play well, it's just another kind of piece in that confidence puzzle heading into next year. And I think that'd be really, really good to see for them.
The last of the three day after Christmas, bowl games, Foster Farms Bowl. That's up in Santa Clara at Levi Stadium. The Nebraska Cornhuskers with a 5-7 record, but a pretty good APR score. So they get in, taking on
UCLA Bruins.
All right. The nightcap on the day after Christmas, 6:15 PM on ESPN, 8-4 UCLA versus 5-7 Nebraska. UCLA is favored by 6.5. And I guess I'll provide my preview. you know, I'll lead off with this. I don't think UCLA covers. Nebraska, if you look at what they've done this year, they've lost a lot of games. I mean, they've lost 7 games. Only 2 of those came by more than 6.5 points. One against Iowa, where they lost by 8, and one kind of inexplicable game against Purdue, which is a really bad team, by 10. Other than that, they've played a ton of close games or won. They lost by 2 to Northwestern. They lost by 2 to Wisconsin. They lost by 1 to Illinois. They lost by 3 to Miami. They lost by 5 to BYU. They played a ton of close games. They're much, much better than their record indicates. And I think this is going to be a much tougher game than a lot of people are expecting heading into this one. Nebraska's a tough matchup for UCLA because Tommy Armstrong can run, and he can run really well. And Mike Riley, you know, he's definitely had some detractors in Nebraska this year, and definitely through his last years at Oregon State, kind of looked like he was phoning it in a little bit. But when you give that guy time to prepare, he's still a very good tactician and a very good coach. I wouldn't be surprised if he really utilizes the run more in this game than he did in the previous 12, because he's got a weapon in Tommy Armstrong. He's got 3 months after this with no football before spring practice. So if he gets a little dinged up running the ball 20 times in this game, it's not that big of a deal. I think he's going to run Tommy Armstrong a good amount because that's proven to be effective against UCLA this year. Running quarterbacks have done real damage to UCLA this season, and I think he's going to be able to. So I think Nebraska is going to be able to score points on UCLA's defense, and then it's just a question of Nebraska's decent enough defense stopping UCLA's offense enough. I think it's going to be a close game. I think it's going to be one possession. I'm not even sure. I think I've got UCLA winning by 3 right now, but I could go the other way and have Nebraska winning it outright. But I definitely don't have UCLA covering the 6.5. I think that's a little big for this game.
Yeah, it's weird. I'm going to agree with you again on this one. And Nebraska's so close to, you know, they've had heart. My wife's a big Tennessee fan, and they had these heartbreaking losses And their heartbreaking losses pale in comparison to the Nebraska heartbreaking losses.
Yeah.
I have a bunch of friends that are, you know, my buddy was a kicker on the Nebraska team for a while. And, he was on the sideline for the, I think it was the Iowa game. And he said the players, like, were coming off the field just so frustrated with Tommy Armstrong because they were guys wide open and he was skipping balls in and just not missing them. So I agree with you. I think he's going to be able to run the football pretty well, but just, you know, he doesn't make the greatest decisions as far as, in the passing game. And, you know, I think it's going to take Mike Riley a little while to get his guy.
What you
in
mean,
there.
Ryan, is that he threw four interceptions against Iowa and no touchdowns.
Oh, is that's kind of what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly what you meant.
So he frustrates the players. I think UCLA is going to win this one. I'm borderline cover. But I think I'm going to stick with the, you know, maybe like a field goal, 4 or 5 point win, something like that. So I'll go with you on this one and say, take Nebraska in the points, but I'm on the fence. I kind of think, I'm going to stick with that. I'm going to stick with, Nebraska covering, but UCLA winning.
Yeah. I think Riley this year, he was trying to fit kind of a square peg into a round hole with Armstrong. He was trying to fit a guy who's not a pocket passer, not a West Coast quarterback into a West Coast system. Cause he's got his pro style system. He's, what is he? Riley's 61, 62 years old. He's not going to change his system at this point.
Yeah.
He added a little bit more running to his scheme, a little bit more zone read, but really it was his scheme with a little bit more running of the quarterback. I think going into this one, given they're 5-7, given they have nothing to lose, given that there's, you know, adding another win this year would be great for Riley going into next year just to kind of build his case for, you know, if they're bad again next year, keeping his job for another year, I think getting to 6-7 would be pretty big for him. I think he's going to go into this looking at it tactically. How do I beat this UCLA team? Not how do I establish my system more? Not how do I, you know, build for next year? I think he's really going to go in with the focused mentality of how do I beat this UCLA team? And I think that's going to come down to Tommy Armstrong, you know, running 20 times. He hasn't done that this year. I mean, I think he's only had 88 carries this year, and that includes sacks. So I think they're probably going to run him a bunch, see what UCLA even does against it, because they've been bad against the zone read this year and bad against design quarterback runs. And if UCLA's, you know, suddenly gotten a lot more disciplined, then that'll be really good. But I just don't see it. I think it's a personnel issue. You know, UCLA's linebackers haven't reacted. They're a little bit, you know, aside from Jayon Brown, they're not super quick, super fast. And Tommy Armstrong's both of those things. And I think you put him in a one-on-one matchup against the linebacker, he's going to beat him pretty much every time. So I think it's going to come down to, for UCLA, I think it's really going to come down to the offense and Josh Rosen and, you know, what he can put together. We should mention Noel Mazzone, UCLA's offensive coordinator, is either limited or out for this game because he had a blood clots in his lung, which is obviously a very serious thing, and we wish him the best, but how that affects UCLA's offense is anyone's guess. So, gonna be a really interesting game. I think it's actually gonna be a really fun game. I think it should be back and forth. I think it'll be very shootouty. So should be a fun nightcap on ESPN. It sounds like about 30,000 people are going to be at the game, but apparently it draws good television ratings the day after Christmas. So that's all that matters.
Gotcha. All right. So that'll be 8-4 UCLA. 5-7 Nebraska. Like Dave said, ESPN at 6:15 PM. On December 26th. We'll do two more that are in December, and then we'll have, I guess we'll try to do the recap or the preview of the other games.
Thursday of next week?
Yeah, I mean, something like that. I think that's what we'll have to try to do.
You know, there's no one I would rather hang out with and talk to on New Year's Eve than you.
You know, Dave, I appreciate that, and I appreciate the friendship we've been able to build over this podcast of Champions Run.
But you do not agree in any way.
I'll actually be back. I'll be back because I'll be back from the bowl game. So
there you go.
We'll be watching stuff. All right, that'll be a good day to do it right between.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay, so the Lockheed Martin Armed Forces Bowl. This is another one in Texas.
Oh yeah.
And it's with an Armed Forces team with Air Force 8-3 from the Mountain West taking on your
California Golden Bears.
Yeah, so this is going to be interesting. Cal's favored by 7. They're 7-5. Air Force, 8-5. Another 11 a.m. showdown on December 29th. ESPN. I don't know what's with all these 11 a.m. games. I can't imagine anyone is watching, but whatever. It's going to be a very interesting game. I'm excited to hear, though, what our man Ryan Gorsey has to say about this. And let's just, you know, take a moment of silence for 11-1 Cal. I don't think we really took a moment beyond that first game where they lost their second. So I think we should all take a moment. All right, now on to Ryan Gorsey.
Here we go.
This is Ryan Gorsey, publisher of BearTerritory.net, FirstCount.com, here with your Cal Bowl preview. It's going to be a 2007 rematch as the Golden Bears face Air Force in the Armed Forces Bowl in Texas at TCU's M&G Carter Stadium. Now, the big thing for me, of course, is going to be Air Force's rushing attack. They have 7 players who rushed for 300 yards or more this season. Talking to Cal's defensive line and linebackers coach, the key is to not overplay and to not overextend. Cal certainly is going to be bigger, stronger, and more athletic than Air Force, but the main thing is they're going to be faster, so you can't overshoot because Air Force and all these service academies don't have guys or the types of athletes that Cal or any other Power 5 school has. You have to maintain gap discipline, and you can't overplay. So Cal is really going to have to maintain the gap integrity, and they're going to have to play very sound, very assignment sound football. Another key thing for me, Cal has allowed just 6 sacks over the final 5 games after having allowed 20 over the previous 7. Now they've also allowed 16 tackles for loss over the final 5 games compared to the 47 that they gave up in the first 7 games of the season. The Cal offensive line is playing so much better than they were over the first, really, a half plus of the season. Now, why is that key? Air Force is 19th in the nation in sacks with 2.77 per game. They're 3rd in sacks per opponent passing attempt, and Cal, of course, does pass the ball a lot, and why wouldn't you? With Jared Goff, who's among the national leaders in many, almost all the offensive categories that matter for quarterbacks. Air Force is also 32nd in the nation in tackles for loss with 7 per game and 23rd in fewest passing yards allowed. So this is really going to be strength versus strength. Certainly not a game that Cal can look at and go, oh, okay, we're clearly better athletes. We're clearly better. This is going to be a cakewalk. Not so. Remember the last time Cal played Air Force in the Armed Forces Bowl, the Bears got down 21-0 before coming back and winning on the back of Kevin Riley, DeSean Jackson, Robert Jordan, and safety Thomas Decoux, who all came off the bench in the second quarter. Now, Cal has set single-season school marks this year for passing yards with 4,425 yards, passing touchdowns with 38, and total offense with 6,293. So very much prolific offense, but again, very heavy on the air raid, part of the Bear Raid moniker there, so it will be a lot of fun to watch down there. In Fort Worth, Daniel Lasco, Cal's running back, should be fully healthy. The key for me is going to be Kenny Lawler. He was limping around over the last 3 games of the season after Oregon with a bad right hip buttocks injury. He's looked as good as he has all season during bowl practice, as has Darius Powell. Those are 2 key receivers that Cal is going to need to have big games against Air Force. This is Ryan Gorsey of BearTerritory.net and Scout.com, and that's been your Cal Armed Forces Bowl preview.
Did Ryan Gorsey really refer to a buttocks injury in there?
I think he did.
I snorted a little. I'm sorry. occasionally I am a 12-year-old. Like, you know how you occasionally have those moments where you still are 12 years old? That was right there. Nice. This is going to be interesting. I think Cal's losing. I think this is one of those where I think the motivation standpoint actually is the big one here. Air Force is going to be motivated. I think they're going to be excited to be in a bowl game, excited to be in this bowl game, really pumped to play Cal, the whole deal. I think Air Force is a pretty good team. I think they've got some weapons. I think they've got a rushing attack that can exploit Cal's rush defense quite a bit. And I think Cal's motivation could be non-existent in this one. Their coach just very publicly kind of made it that apparent that he wanted to be gone, got his contract extension, but that can't sit well with a lot of the leadership of the team, or I would have to imagine it doesn't. I think this could be a really, really interesting game from that standpoint. And from that standpoint, motivation is so big in bowl games. I keep talking about it, but it's so big. And I don't know how motivated they're going to be to play in this one, especially after starting the year 5-0, ending 7-5. I think Air Force not only covers the 7, I think they win this game.
Well, okay, so it's Cal -7.
Cal minus 7.
All right, so Dave is going to go Air Force.
Outright.
Outright. Wow. Okay, I'm going to talk myself into something here. When we saw the Cal defense play well this year, usually they're forcing turnovers, and I don't think this is not like the kind of, you know, the Air Force offense is not the kind of, it's not this high risk one where, you know, the ball's flopping all over, but I just don't think they're going to turn the ball over. So I think you're going to see them be able to run the football on Cal.
What is the military, Ryan? The military's discipline.
Discipline. We saw the trend early. The Arizona game, you play a bowl that's like about your opponent. You play the New Mexico Bowl against New Mexico. You would think New Mexico has some sort of advantage there. Well, this is the Armed Forces Bowl against an Armed Forces program.
And it's Lockheed Martin. They produce airplanes.
Oh my God. So that's, yeah. So I'm in now. I'm going to take Air Force plus 7. I'm not going to say that they win outright. But I will take the points. And Air
Life
Force
is about risk, Ryan. Life's about risk.
Right. Yeah. We have to do something a little bit different, but I'll take Air Force as well. I think Goff is going to have a pretty good game though, but I kind of feel shootouty a little maybe.
Yeah.
Don't see Cal stopping him all that much.
It's on at 11 a.m. Kind of a weird game time.
That is a weird game time.
It's kind of, it's going to be weird. It's going to be weird. That's what, 9 a.m. Pacific? Texas?
I'm taking it outright, Air Force.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to agree again. But I think you talked me into it. The Lockheed Martin thing put it over the top. Like, they do make airplanes.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's 11 a.m. Pacific, so it's 1 p.m. local time.
1 p.m. Okay. Another Texas game.
Yeah.
All right. That was Cal. Thanks for Ryan Gorsey sending that in. We have one more bowl to preview that's in the year of 2015. It's the Holiday Bowl down in San Diego, California at one of the worst stadiums I've ever been to, Qualcomm.
Mm-hmm. Terrible stadium.
So awful. Probably the Chargers are done there. We might be getting them in LA. We'll see. But the Wisconsin Badgers, 9-3, from the Big Ten that has 14 teams, taking on
USC Trojan.
8-5 USC against 9-3 Wisconsin. On the day before New Year's Eve, 12:30, it's on at 7:30 p.m. USC is favored by 3, ESPN. The National Funding Holiday Bowl, because nothing gets you more excited for a bowl game than National Funding. Ryan, give me the USC preview here.
Yeah, it's funny. National Funding, I went, actually drove down for the San Diego press conference just because we hadn't spoke to Clay Helton for a while. Mm-hmm. We were going to get a chance to. And so we got to meet the guy who's basically the CEO of National Funding. Like they do, I think it's some kind of venture capital thing or something. I didn't really pay enough attention, but he's basically a big USC fan, USC alumni. They didn't have a sponsor and he's like, I'll sponsor it. So he's sponsoring the bowl game because USC's in it and he's a USC alum. So that's kind of a funny
story.
That's
awesome.
Yeah. he was like entrepreneur of the year or something in like 2007. I mean, there was something kind of going on there. I got to talk to him for a while. Seemed like a really nice guy. Him and his wife, they're big USC fans. But yeah, so he was down there and was like, yeah, I'll have our company sponsor the bowl game.
That's too cool.
And, that was always, they always used to have cool sponsors though, like the, Pacific Life. Like I thought that was the best sponsor. I don't know why that hasn't worked out anymore, but
yeah,
whatever. Okay. So Wisconsin 9-3. I think there's motivation there. Paul Chris is his, first year. As a head coach, because you guys know Gary Anderson left Wisconsin and came to, Oregon State. So he's in the Pac-12 now. I think he's done a pretty good job. They haven't really like beat anyone good. They've just kind of done what you're supposed to do. The offensive line is kind of beat up for Wisconsin. It's not the same kind of, Wisconsin team. They have a really great defense. They just haven't played a lot of good quarterbacks. Like Cody Kessler will probably be the best quarterback they play this year, which is, kind of weird, but I think they have the number one scoring defense in the country and number three total defense. So it's certainly a stout defensive team. It's not like the kind of bruising offensive line. They've got banged up a lot. So it's not the same kind of Ron Dane sort of stuff that you remember from the Wisconsin days of old. But, it's still a good team. I think it's a team that's going to be motivated and I think they're going to play well, for Paul Chryst. On the USC side, you know, Dave loves to talk about the motivation factor, and that's a big issue here for me. I think it's an important game for Clay Helton, but they've had so many other weird kind of things going on. He's fired half his staff. So half of the assistant coaches that were there are, you know, to start the season or in the middle of the season are now gone. And you have graduate assistants that are doing more. You have former administrative assistants promoted to, you know, full-time roles. And so guys that you would see kind of hanging out on the sidelines are now running position drills. And I think those guys are motivated. They're getting a chance to audition and try to be a coach because I don't think those guys signed up to be, I want to be administrative assistant all my life. They want to be the linebacker coach or whatever. And now they get to be that. But that's half your staff is like basically just promoted guys that weren't normally doing this before. They haven't had a lot of practices. They didn't start practice until Saturday. And some of the coach speak we've been getting from Clay Helton, he's like touting how many, we got to practice all these many times, this many times. They really took 2 weeks off. And it's kind of like they had a regular week of practice this week, starting on Saturday. They're playing on grass. They've only practiced on grass once. They practiced on turf the rest of the time. They, you know, the last 2 days, they've been no pads practice, almost like walkthrough sort of things. So I'm not saying they're not going to be motivated. I think there's motivation here to try to win, but I'm a little concerned or questioning the preparation and how things going because you kind of have one eye on this game and one eye on next year, you know, and putting the staff together and playing Alabama and having Alabama, Utah State, Stanford and Utah, your first four games. And I can kind of see that. And this is really Clay Helton's first shot. I think it's important for him to win and it would build them some momentum, but I think it's more important for him to get his whole staff together and get what he, you know, wants going there. So To me, Dave, motivation factor, I see some concerns. USC could come out and play like gangbusters, but I'm guessing they don't just because there's all these other kind of things kind of on everybody else's mind. So I'm going to take Wisconsin plus the 3, but I think that Wisconsin can win this one outright.
This that whole spiel will not go on any campaign posters for Clay Helton right there. I tend to agree. I think, and that's the kiss of death for Wisconsin. They should really just not even go there anymore, because I'm agreeing with you that they could win this game. And I've been the kiss of death for anybody associated with USC this year. But I think motivational standpoint is going to be really, really weird. I think the whole coaching staff situation is really weird. You know, if you've got a whole kind of new staff you're breaking in to do all this stuff, maybe you want more than 7 practices before the bowl game. Yeah. Maybe. I mean, you know, to organize who's going to call plays or, you know, massage some egos of guys who weren't promoted to OC or whatever, you know, do some things. Is T. Martin going to be calling plays for this one? Do we know?
Yeah. So he's going to, Clay Helton's still going to call the plays for this one, but T. Martin's been more involved in the offensive planning. And a lot of times at practice, we saw Clay Helton kind of running the scout, you know, working on the defensive side and T. Martin will run the offense. But, from what we were told, it's Clay Helton will still call the plays in this one.
Nice. So has anybody talked to Marcus Tuiasosopo? How is he feeling? Just in general.
I didn't get to talk to him.
Marcus?
Yeah, I didn't get to talk to him. But he's definitely, you know, he's coaching the quarterbacks and stuff now.
That's something.
It's interesting. I mean, Clay Helton talked about, well, we had 7 practices before Stanford and that, or 5 practices before Stanford. I'm like, nah, I think there was only 3. Plus, like, you had a whole different staff then, you know, like, it was just kind of weird, like, how this has been going out. I get it. I think he has reasons for not having as many practices. I think because you got that new staff or you had to promote these guys, you had to kind of get them up to speed. They were beat up a little bit. So I think taking 2 weeks off was part of his plan. But I think he knows that it could look bad that you're not practicing as much. So I think he's kind of used some of his coach speak to tout how many practices they've had. And our numbers don't really match what their numbers are. Not that, I mean, that's a matters all that much, I guess, but I think there's all these little reasons to be concerned about. If you're a USC fan, they didn't practice a whole lot. Oh, they didn't do this. They didn't do that. They have all these new coaches. To me, I think it all adds up to, it's hard for me to pick USC in this one. They could win. They could come out and play well, but all the little factors kind of going the other way. That's why I'm leading Wisconsin.
And I think Wisconsin's going to be excited to be there in San Diego during winter. And, you know, most of Wisconsin will be in San Diego for that game as they travel extensively for these bowl games. So,
yes.
I think there's a lot of points in Wisconsin's favor in that regard. And it's going to be I think it's going to be a fun game. You know, you're right, though. Wisconsin really, I mean, they haven't really beaten anyone good this year. And their defense is pretty good, but their offense is kind of not. and, you know, I think they should be able to, you know, shut down USC's running game to an extent. I think they've got a pretty good run defense, but I just don't know if they have the athletes to match up against USC, if USC can get it going. And that's the real guess. I mean, that's the one where we kind of have to guess at it week after week. You know, they've kind of had the thing where they do the high point, the low point, the high point, the low point. And that's been the case all year. And they just had a low point against Stanford, or not just, but 2 weeks ago they had a low point against Stanford. Maybe this is another high point for them. Who knows? But I think you're right to point to all those motivational factors. The LA teams in general, these two teams, when they're in mid to low tier bowl games, all bets are off because I think they get so, I don't know. I think they get so glitzy and enamored with, you know, the idea of playing in Rose Bowls or beyond. I just think something, you know, I think it's the same thing we're talking about with Miami. When you have to go to Miami to El Paso for a bowl game, kind of a step down. When you have to go from LA to really anywhere for a bowl game, not so great. I think that can always come into play for these two teams. So, if Ryan and I kind of sound sour when we're talking about LA teams playing in bowl games, that's probably why.
And, you know, I've talked to some of the USC beat writers about this today. You watch this team so, I mean, you cover a team, you see all the warts, you know, and sometimes you see them too much. You kind of miss the good stuff because you're looking for, you know the good and the bad and stuff, I guess you could say. And, so I could be completely wrong, but that's just kind of what my gut is with this one.
All right. Well, so those are our previews. Those are our recaps. And then, we'll have more of those next week, but, we've got questions and stuff, don't we?
We do. We have some voicemail questions, and some of them are, like I said, long.
I hear you.
I'll play. This one's kind of short, so I'll play this one first, and then we'll see how it goes. Here you go.
Hey, Dave and Ryan. This is Danny calling in from L.A. In response to Dave's threats to cancel the show if no voicemails came in, so here I am. This question's primarily for Dave, but Ryan, I'd love your thoughts on this too. As much as I hate to say it, I think Jim Mora overall has done a good job in changing the football culture at UCLA and has some pretty good seasons to show for it. Dave, what are some of the things, both good and bad, that you've seen Mora do in his tenure that can serve as advice or lesson points for Clay Helton as he takes on his new role at USC? Thanks, guys. Keep up the good work. Love the show. Bye.
Ooh, that's a tough question to come in cold on. great question. I think what Mora did early on, and this is something that I think desperately needs to happen at USC, and I'm not sure how much a head coach. So it's a different situation. USC has a lot of institutional football background and inertia and the whole thing. I mean, it's not, as famously been described by a few people, like Pat Hayden wants to be involved, like listening to play calling and stuff. So it's not like Mora, where he's coming in and establishing a real football culture. Helton kind of has to, you know, almost change some things from the inside. And it's not as easy there, to change things because he's kind of having to work with the machinery that's been there for decades. But I think what Mora did is he used his kind of force of personality, used, you know, kind of, his early changes, you know, stopping UCLA players from going over the wall during a bowl practice and that sort of thing. And he used all that kind of seriousness around the program to effect some changes, to get a football facility built, do all that sort of thing. And I think Helton needs to change the culture. I think USC's culture has been a problem, kind of a country club atmosphere around the admin, but also, just a general seriousness about preparation and things. And this is from an outsider perspective. You can probably speak to it more, but I mean, there's very little reason why a team with that much talent, underachieves the way they do, year after year. And I think he's got some culture things to figure out, and Ryan can probably speak to the specifics, but just from an outsider perspective, I'd say culture is a big issue there. And then, you know, some missteps Moore's made, most of the complaints I have with Mora from an in-game perspective, I think the first coach who actually starts making effective decisions on fourth down stands to win a lot of games, especially with the talent that USC has or UCLA has. I think Mora has been very conservative on fourth downs, and I think any coach starting a new gig, and Helton could be that guy, should be more aggressive on fourth downs. Punting is just a controlled turnover, and I think teams should really, at all levels of football, should punt about half as much, if not less, than they currently do. And I think that'd be a nice thing for Helton to do. I think if he gave that kind of mindset and actually gave a really aggressive reasons for why he's doing that, I think that would, first of all, I think it would make USC a more productive football team, and then it would also, maybe be make him kind of a revolutionary in the field. So, I don't know, kind of coming in cold on that question, but yeah. that's about as good as I can do.
No, that's good. I agree with you there. On the Helton side, I think he has to be a lot more aggressive on the defensive side of the football. He made that pretty clear. Justin Wilcox was not. The one game they were aggressive was against UCLA, and they won. And they kind of went back to the way they're kind of playing soft before against Stanford, and they lost. So I'll be interesting to see what they do in the bowl game for this. But he's got a lot of work. He's got his work cut out for him. He's got a lot of stuff to do there. I love what Jim Mora has been able to do culture-wise. And like Dave said, it's kind of different. There's different things that, like, you kind of had to establish some of the things at UCLA that might have been already in place at USC, and you had to kind of do some different things at USC that you don't really have to at USC. I mean, there's different challenges, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
But I think Jim Mora attacked the right spots and, changed the culture and paying assistants more and facilities. Like, I think there's the establishment around him, I think, is getting better. And, the next step is not just making a Pac-12 championship game, but, winning one and going to the Rose Bowl and winning a Rose Bowl. I think he's, you can't put all your eggs in just beating USC.
No.
And I feel like there has been a lot of emphasis kind of on that, which is great when you're winning. You lose one, then it's like, well, now what are we touting? You want to be able to tout, yeah, we're beating USC, but that's like kind of an afterthought. That's, hey, make it to the Rose Bowl. We're winning Rose Bowl games. We're beating a Big Ten team in the Rose Bowl, things like that. So, but I think he's definitely, it's going in the right direction. There's a toughness around the program. It's not the gutty little Bruins or whatever. I mean, this is a tough football team. And I think, so yeah, I like what he's doing. It's about time though to take that next step, and we'll see what they're able to do. Very talented team, see what the recruiting class looks like and all of that.
Yeah, what Mora did was essentially make UCLA kind of more serious about football, which needed to happen. And there wasn't really any, there was no commitment to football for 15 years, and he got him to make a commitment to football, which that's, in the grand scheme of things, that's a pretty basic accomplishment. It was tough to do, but it was a pretty basic accomplishment. Helton's got, I think, a tougher challenge ahead of him, because he's got to take a program that is, in a sense, serious about football, but turn them into a kind of a modern machine for winning at football. Because right now, I think they still kind of approach, and this is, again, from an outsider perspective, USC, from an administration perspective, still approaches it as if it's kind of the 1970s in terms of, football and the landscape of things. And I think they need to promote, kind of approach it institutionally more like a modern thing, where, just the way they hire coaches, the way they do certain things. And it's not, it's kind of weird because Helton's kind of hired through that, way of doing things. And I think he needs to almost change that way of doing things if they're going to have the success that they probably should, given the talent level in that program.
Yeah. It's, when you hire people that are kind of indebted to you, you're not changing a lot,
And
that's kind of what they've been doing. If they would have got, if you get a Chip Kelly or something, he's going to come in and do it his way and make big changes. And I kind of get the feeling that USC administration didn't want that. They wanted someone that's kind of with the program already. And when you're trying to change a culture, not always the best thing. So, like I said,
it took UCLA bottoming out before they got out of that attitude. It took them, having 2 4-8 seasons and, 3 years under Rick Neuheisel before they decided that wasn't the way to go.
Yeah.
So I don't know if USC ever gets to that level. I kind of doubt it, but maybe a few 500 seasons in a row would do the job. But yeah, I think they're one more coaching hire away from that kind of attitude shift.
Okay, so we have two more voicemails that are both 3 minutes or plus.
Well, I think our guy emailed us and said the second recording was better than the first, which I think means that he did a second version of the same recording.
I did. I didn't listen to both of them. They were both about the same. They both ended the same way. So I don't know how, I can start playing it for you, and then maybe you should have buzzer power, Dave. So if you just buzz in, go, then I'll stop it.
Okay.
Does that work?
That works for me great.
Okay, here you go.
Hey guys, West Coast Ron here. The coach's screenplay had to be put on the shelf with all the hirings and firings, so we're going to instead meld it together with the media guys on the island and at the end have some sort of hunger game for survival rather than just automatically burning down Greg Biggins' hut and John McKay, et cetera, et cetera. So, and this will be a prequel that puts those two together. So here we go. While rummaging through the attic of his late grandfather, the mad scientist, Dr. Abraham Strangebrew, an unnamed Pac-12 media member discovers in a hidden wall compartment a formula for spray-applied truth serum. Immediately realizing the potential, said media guy works feverishly in the basement of his near Fresno State safe house and adapts a microphone that can be placed under a speaker's face when asked questions. The serum is designed to only affect the person for about 30 to 60 seconds, which gives this reporter the advantage of being the only guy to get honest answers. Voila! In no time at all, said media guy gets Pac-12 referees to make honest statements after poorly called games such as, "I'm often quite distracted by other stuff during the game, so things will get missed." Or statements like,
Give me the recap, Ryan. Give me the recap.
Oh, I don't have the recap. That's he wrote one, didn't he?
Yeah, you told me that you would have a recap ready for the remainder of the phone call.
Wait,
and now you're failed.
Did I say that?
You failed me.
No, I didn't mean that. Sorry.
Good stuff from West Coast Ron. I think we should post the entirety of the voicemail. I think we should post that on the site, text of the voicemail.
I like that. Okay.
Yeah, because I think it's an important prequel. I think if we're interested in the full story, I think we really need to get to the whole thing. I just think, you know, we've already hit the hour mark.
Yeah.
We've got a long ways to go on this pure podcast of champions right here. And I feel like, you know, probably 95% of our listenership wants to hear the prequel, but those 5%, they're vocal. And we gotta listen to them right now.
You know, I'll add this at the end. I'll tag this on at the end so you can hear.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go.
Okay. So sorry, right. You got to listen to some of that, but thanks, West Coast Ron.
That was good stuff, West Coast Ron. I liked it.
Yeah, the whole Hunger Games aspect.
Some email questions.
Was I the media guy? Was that me?
Yeah, you were Dr. Abraham Strangebrew.
Okay, cool. We also have one more. It's a long voicemail too. I can play the beginning of it if you want, or do you want to do email ones?
If we've got another voicemail, let's listen to another voicemail.
Okay, we'll have to cut this at some point because it's a pretty long rant, but you'll get the gist of it early, I think.
Yeah. Hey, since you guys said you weren't going to do the podcast unless you got a voicemail, here's your voicemail. So I do enjoy the podcast, like it very much. It's probably my favorite thing that I got from Bruin Report. Following that. So thanks for that. I do have one comment. I was just listening to your discussion on the greatest quarterback of all time, and I really just wish that David Woods would push back on this notion that all these Trojans are the greatest players. They are not. They're NFL players. They were paid. I know there's this lawsuit and all this. Reggie Bush's family got paid. Pete Carroll had agents hovering around the players all day long. These guys, there were stories about the cars they drove, etc. These were paid players. Of course they were the best team. Imagine for a second if LeBron James went to Duke right now. All of a sudden, he'd be the greatest college player. Herbstreit does this all the time about the SC game against Oklahoma that they won by, you know, 40 points. Well, that's the greatest team I've ever seen, he always says. Yes, it's a pro team playing a college team. It's the greatest team you've ever seen. Just like if the Patriots today played against Alabama, they would crush them by 40 points. Yes?
Was that a
buzz? So, yeah. I hear what he's saying.
Okay.
I hear what he's saying. I can imagine the way it goes from here.
Yes. About two more minutes worth of that.
Here's what I'd say. Let's just let's just posit something right here. I'm not saying it's true. I'm just, let's say, just for the sake of argument, USC's players get paid. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that happens. When they play like an LSU of the world, I mean, do we really think that LSU is maybe not getting paid? I mean, if we're for the sake of argument saying USC is getting paid, what do we think they're doing in SEC country?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever's happened on the West Coast anywhere, if you want to say USC is the worst violator, it would pale in comparison to anything that's going on in the SEC.
Well, and I hate to be in this position where I'm defending the sanctity of USC, but
you love look, it.
if you look at the players who played in college football, I mean, okay, so throw out the couple of titles they've got vacated with, you know, Reggie Bush and the whole thing. So throw out Reggie Bush from that all-century team. Look, I didn't even look at the damn thing, but I imagine it's full of Trojans because, I mean, guess what? USC's won like, I don't know, how many national titles have they claimed now?
11.
I mean, how many like 1920s titles are there in there, 1930s titles? They've claimed a bunch. They've won a bunch. So it makes sense that they probably are full on that all-century team. It makes sense, guys. Gotta live with it.
There's a lot of Rose Bowls there. And it's
a lot of winning teams. A lot of good winning teams. And the Pac-12 certainly been, or the Pac-10 and the Pac-12 have certainly been more competitive since, you know, the mid-1970s or, you know, probably early 1980s than it was previous to that. And so you can make an argument that the last 30 years have made it a more competitive conference. But even in that time, USC's won more national titles than anyone else. So for better or worse, USC is the standard bearer of the conference, and it makes sense for USC players to be all over that all-century team. That's kind of the long and the short of it.
It's funny. I kind of got the feeling, Dave, and we love our voicemail callers, that there was some sort of way, well, I have to justify this in my head. So USC was, they paid everybody. It was a professional team. Reggie Bush was just so, you know, like the only accusation about Reggie Bush was he was getting paid to leave school, not getting paid to come to school. I have a real issue with if you find out that a school is paying a recruit or whatever, like I hate that. I hate when you see that happen. So when Cam Newton won a championship at Auburn and you know, there was like this $200,000 payment to his dad's church or whatever it was. I think that's real. I mean, that's an ineligible player.
Can I hot take right now? Can I make a hot take?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't care if anybody gets paid. Really? Pay as much money as you want. They should take at every single player should take exactly as much money as is offered and not a penny less. I think they should all cheat as hard as possible because the NCAA is BS. These kids should all be able to get paid as much money as they want to make. Because anybody else can get paid in school. Why can't the players who bring a bunch of money in? That's my take on it.
I like it. Fair point.
So there you go.
All right. Well, I'm sorry we didn't get to play the whole rant, but it was pretty good.
I get where he's coming from. 100%. I understand what you're saying. I think in the context of the all-century team, I don't think it makes much sense. I mean, even if you throw out those couple of vacated titles for what's turning out to be, at least from the provable standpoint, what's turning out to be some trumped up stuff. I think it's still pretty obvious that USC's, you know, should have been well represented on the all century team.
All right. We got some emails.
Some emails.
All right.
All right. We've got another one from Hiflode Almond, a good friend of the program. Larry Scott in the Pac-12's negotiating positions. I wish that Pac-12 fans who complain about Larry Scott and the vagaries of television contracts would take a long look in the mirror. They've somehow got the idea that there's a huge national clamor for the Pac-12's best football in the universe, and therefore it must be Larry Scott's fault that he's gotten lowballed. The opposite is the case. Scott can't leverage a better offer for his content because it simply has a lower market value. Pac-12 fans are just not as rabid for the game as Big Ten or SEC fans are. And making matters worse, the big market schools, Washington, Cal, and yes, USC and UCLA, haven't been pulling their weight for what's pushing a decade. The two dominant conference powers during Scott's tenure have been Stanford, a school that has fewer fans nationally than can fit in their stadium, and Oregon, which has tried to pluck a national brand out of thin neon. It puts me in mind of Ted Miller's admonishment for his ESPN power rankings. If you don't like where you're at, play better. I completely with you. I think you're pretty much dead on. And I think it's something we probably don't mention enough here, but Yeah, I think the power brands in the Pac-12 haven't been playing well for a while. You know, historically, UCLA is like the second best program in the Pac-12, and they were garbage since 1998 until the Mora years. So I think that's hurt. I think USC not being really good since, what, 2007, 2008 has hurt. And Washington, again, probably the third best historical program in the Pac-12, being pretty bad most of the last decade. I think all three of those things have hurt quite a bit.
Yeah, I agree with the emailer, and I do think that you have, it's a little bit different, you know, the palette you have to work with is a little different than what you have in the SEC, but I think he's made some poor choices, and I think with the network and not teaming up with somebody where I think the choice he made to have his own independent network would have been a lot better if it was the SEC network, because it's the SEC, everyone's going to get it and you have to force to it, but because the distribution problems, I think part of it is because they're independent, and part of it's because it's not as desirable as a product. Not as many people out there asking for it. But I think to choose to go independent like that, you almost needed a more desirable product. So I think some of the decisions he made have been poor too. But I agree with you. It's a different kind of beast than when you're dealing with the SEC.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, and we've got our requisite email from Nick from Cyprus. You ready?
Sure, Nick.
Review of games and questions. This is Nick from Cyprus. First and foremost, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. Right back at you, Nick. Review. Utah 35 versus BYU 28, Holy War Part 2. Coach Whittingham wins number 10 this season. Utah almost blew a big lead, but won at the end. New BYU coach, we will get back to this new hire in my questions. Arizona 45 versus New Mexico 38. Didn't watch the game because, well, both teams aren't good and not interesting. Sorry. And it was also actually Arizona 45, New Mexico 37. Good win for Arizona. Looks like Rich Rod sticks around. Maybe next year will be better. Questions. With BYU hires Oregon State's defensive coordinator Kalani Sitake, where does that leave Oregon State, who was the drizzling poops this year? The one and probably only bright spot of that team was their D. They lose their coordinator. Do they get worse from this season? I don't think they can be worse from this season, but it certainly isn't a good thing. I don't think Gary Anderson could have anticipated Sitake getting that job offer in particular this year, because I don't think anybody walking into this year thought Bronco Mendenhall was going to leave. So I think for Gary Anderson, that's going to leave him scrambling a little bit. I think Sitake... Yeah, important from a D standpoint, but also he was a really good recruiter for Oregon State. He had started to open up a pipeline for Polynesian recruits especially, and I think that might change without Sitake there. So I think it's kind of a back-to-the-drawing-board moment for Gary Anderson, because I think he had the idea of building a team built around kind of some power football, some big, strong defensive linemen, and maybe make them kind of Utah North. And I think that might have to change without Sitake, or maybe have to be adjusted a little bit. So definitely not a good thing for Oregon State. I think he could be really good at BYU. I think he could recruit well there and run kind of that system that they like to run there. But yeah, what are your thoughts on Oregon State going forward?
I agree with you. It's hard to get worse, but that's a big setback. I think you might have thought he would take a defensive coordinator job somewhere else, but really not anticipating him getting a head coaching job at BYU. I mean, that's a huge jump. It's great for Kalani Sitake. I mean, it's hard to hire at BYU because you have to be, you have to be Mormon. You have to be, LDS. So it's a weird situation there. I think they have co-offensive coordinators now. Like they've made some changes to the staff. I don't think they've done the defensive coordinator yet, but to me, it's a blow, and I think it's going to stunt the rebuilding process a little bit. Not going to completely derail everything, but just another thing to kind of overcome. And there's a lot of holes he's trying to fill up there. And that now is one more, and that's a pretty big one.
Yep. And then he's got another question. What team do you think will be trending up next season and trending down next year? Trending up for me, Washington. I think they're going to be potentially a contender in the North. And trending down, I kind of think Stanford finally. Hogan's gone. I don't even know. That's kind of a bad answer. Their defense is going to be pretty good again. Their offense might take a small step back with Bob Christian McCaffrey. Trending down, we'll reverse that and say trending down will be Utah. I think they kind of hit a high point with Devontae Booker and Travis Wilson, and now they've got to kind of figure some things out again. They'll have to break in a new quarterback, have a new running back, and, you know, their defense will take a couple of hits as well. So I think Utah will trend down a little bit, and I think Washington will trend up.
Yeah, that's tough. I'm trying to think. I mean, I think we're trending down. It's harder in the South because so many teams kind of trended down this year. It didn't. The North was really the power. I would guess Stanford, but like I was wrong about them trending down this year. They started down and then just turned it back around and jumped back up. I think Washington for sure. I think Washington State can continue what they're doing, and you know, continue trending up. It's going to be a really interesting race to me in the North. More as interesting as probably thought it was going to be in the South this year, which was kind of a weird year.
Yeah.
It's hard to, I guess I could go with Utah as well. But like, you know, Arizona's was 6-6, you know, are they going to trend? I think they're going to be at least that good. I don't think they're going to get worse. So.
Yeah. And then he asks, can you guys share the craziest bowl game stories that you are willing to share? I hear the first Las Vegas bowl game for USC was a wild time for the men of Troy. I'm trying to think. I think probably Vegas Bowl, one of the Vegas Bowls early on, probably that first one in Doral, I heard a bunch of players were just drunk the night before the game and were hungover for the game. But I'm trying to think if there was anything really crazy.
Yeah.
I don't really have anything. What do you got?
Yeah, not much. I mean, I haven't gone to some of the bowl games recently when we're like, if we're covering recruiting versus a bowl game, if it's a crappy bowl game, then I usually cover the recruiting thing instead of the bowl game itself. I'll have my beat writer go do it. I wasn't in El Paso, but apparently that was nuts just there with, you know, Lane Kiffin came out with the, you know, hoodie on and all that stuff. I mean, so that would have been the big one, but I wasn't there. I was in San Antonio right. Covering the Army All-American Bowl and all those guys.
Right. But I think Vegas for UCLA, I think Vegas for any team probably gets a little hairy if you're kind of when it's a disappointing season and then you end up in Vegas for in December, I think there's always some fun stuff that can happen.
Yeah.
All right. Then we got one more question. Question for the crew. This is from Alex from Pasadena. Back in 2011, the Pac-12 hired what at the time seemed to be really good coaches for the conference. Obviously with Mike Leach finally making some noise this year, how would you consider those hires now? And who's the first to leave? Does Rich Rod stay longer than 1 year or does he already have 1 foot out the door? All right, so let's reverse back to then. In 2011, ASU hired Todd Graham, Arizona hired Rich Rod, UCLA hired Jim Mora. Who else was hired that year? Mike Leach was
Mike
hired
Leach
that
was,
year.
Yeah.
Was that the four? Was there another one? McIntyre was hired the year after, I think, at Colorado.
Shaw was
hired the year before.
Four, yeah.
So I think it was those four. I think it was those four because Peterson was hired, I think, 2 years after. Dykes was hired the year after. Yeah, Dykes has only been there 3 years now. Okay, so it's those four. So how would we grade those four?
As far as like just.
Yeah, how would we evaluate those four? Should we rank them? Which one was the best hire in 2011?
Let's do that. Would you go what? Would you go Leach or Mora, you think?
I think in terms of overall impact on the program, I would probably go Mora.
Yeah.
Because it's taken a program that was really at probably its lowest point over the last decade to once again being, you know, pretty good. Not elite, but pretty good. So I think that's probably the best. But I think you could make an argument for any of those guys, honestly. You can make an argument for Rich Rod winning the South at Arizona, which isn't an easy thing to do. You can make an argument for Graham winning the South at ASU, which isn't an easy thing to do. And Leach, the job he did this year, I think Leach actually for me is number four just because year still was so disappointing going 3-9. But this year, and it's definitely trending up for him, but I think you have to say, for any one of those schools, that was a good hire.
Yeah.
I think every one of those schools has to be happy still at this point, 4 years in, has to be happy with the hire they made in 2011.
That's funny. Like you'd have Leach four and I was thinking about putting him one, you know, so like I think they're all
very close.
Yeah. None of them you're going to be like, oh wow. You know, that all of those guys are people that could be hired away, I would think.
Yeah. And the more answer for me is because I'm close to the situation here. So I know how bad it was kind of internally before he got there and kind of the culture change stuff. But if you're looking at just records on the field, I mean, those guys are all, aside from Leach, who had a worst situation to deal with. They're all pretty close together. And I think Graham and Mora in particular are very close record-wise. I mean, this year might have changed it a little bit, but after the 3 years, they were both pretty close together. It's definitely, I think getting those four guys in the conference definitely raised the coaching caliber in the conference quite a bit.
Yeah, I agree with you.
All right, and then he also asked, does Rich Rod stay longer than 1 year? Does he already have one foot out the door? I think for a college coach, you'll see the rarity that flirts every single offseason, but I think for the most part, they'll have a few serious things. But I think he's probably thinking now, okay, well, I'm going to give this another little bit of time and see what happens. I think if a Godfather offer comes from some big-time school and he, you know, if Texas fires Charlie Strong after next year and they want Rich Rod for some reason, I think he might take it. But I don't know if he's going to flirt with a South Carolina of the world again. I don't know if that's going to be the thing he does after next year. I think he's probably thinking, all right, I'm going to give Arizona another couple of years and then see where things stand at that point. But yeah, I don't see him doing a really strong flirtation next season.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think they're, you know, he's sticking around and let some crazy opportunity comes up.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. That's all of our questions.
Awesome. Well, we, got the show in before Christmas. We got, lots of stuff going on. We'll try to do a New Year's Eve show, like Dave said, and, recap the five bowl games that we just previewed. And then, of course, preview the final three, the bigger ones for the Pac-12. But good stuff, Dave.
Good stuff, Ryan. My child is crying. I should probably tend to her.
You should probably do that.
There's all kinds of things going on.
Nice. All right. Well, Dave, great stuff. That's David Woods. I'm Ryan Abraham. We're the Podcast of Champions. Thank you so much for tuning in.